Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
You're listening to Bernstein and Rahimi on 670 The Score. Doug Glanville. Chicago Cubs first-round pick and nine-year MLB veteran.
Line drive right field, coming high. Bautista can't get it. He gets by him. Glanville's going to get at least three. He might circle him. He might circle him. But Boots waving him on. Boots waving him on. It's an inside-the-park home run. Doug Glanville.
Marquee Network baseball analyst. Host of Class is in Session with Doug Glanville.
Now there's like a revolution around analytics. You know, stealing third base, for example, they could say, well, if you get caught, you've reduced the probability of scoring a run by, you know, 40 percentage point. But if you make it, you've only gained it by 20%. And so you know, stealing third on a Wednesday with a left-handed pitcher with grass that's 2 inches higher on a Sunday. I mean, we could calculate all these things right in baseball.
Doug Glanville with Dan Bernstein and Layla Rahimi right here on 670 The Score.
Oh, man, any day you get a little unexpected Harry Callis in your life is a good day indeed. Doug Glanville joins us now on the Alpamonte Nissan Hotline, Alpamonte Nissan on North Avenue in Melrose Park, or at apnissan.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Doug Glanville. He is part of MLB Network, and he is the host of Class is in Session with Doug Glanville show, debuting tonight with a special MLK Day lineup on Marquee Sports Network, including Jason Hayward and others. Doug, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm getting new to this whole like Twitch community here, so I wanted to be cooler and not have like a phone to my ear, but then maybe that's my signature move, so I'm going to roll with it.
It's very Zach Morris cell phone of you from like Saved by the Bell in the old times. I like it. It's nice to see you and work with you again, Doug. I appreciate this.
No, it's great seeing you, Layla. I mean, you think about, Layla, the times we spent just trying to work it out over the Cubs pre- and post-game, so many years. And I keep appreciating your tweets of people mixing up your name with, Rimini. So it's a tall order, but you do a great job.
If I'm making you laugh with the Leah Remini mix-ups, I'm here for it.
I've been thinking about how to sort of frame where baseball is right now. And I read your wonderful essay that you wrote at ESPN.com about why there are more important things in your life than managerial opportunities at this point, despite how qualified you would be for them. And if you had to judge where we are in baseball culturally, in a calendar year, from last MLK Day to this one, considering everything that's happened, the things of which we are more aware, and all the difficulty and all the turmoil, do you think we're in a better place?
But I think we're in a better place in that we're in transition. You know, it feels like a transition. And the question is, on the other side of that, do you try to lean back into status quo from the past, or do you really embrace the change? And, you know, baseball has had a lot of these moments where you think about Jackie Robinson breaking in 1947, and his story is often framed in, you know, his patience and having a 10-year career champion, but it often falls short within baseball of what he actually did after his career. He was really an activist, you know, and And so that kind of change took, you know, being on the streets, you know, fighting for policy, testifying in court, all the things he did that's kind of under the radar when you think of his legacy through how it's portrayed in Major League Baseball. So the question is, when you don't confront some of these complete pictures of these figures, for example, it's a lot easier to kind of slip back into going back to, you know, what has been in the comfort of sort of reinforcing the privilege that exists of the power structure in baseball. But I'm optimistic in that some change has been incremental and quietly in the shadow. The Selig rule, as an example, which mandates interviewing diverse candidates for different jobs, has been very successful in the lower levels or sort of below the managerial GM level or ownership level, done very well in that regard to get people in the room. Now the question is, once you have the diversity on paper in the numbers, are you really empowered? And so there's a lot of stages to this.
I think that's good that you bring it up, and you talk about the Selig rule in your essay, but we immediately want to think of the managerial role first in baseball. So how do we get to that next step where we do see the representation matter? It was discussed a lot, especially at the beginning of the season. We all talk about Dusty, of course. Ozzie Guillen has talked about it being a Latin manager. Rick Renteria is a Latino manager, or was one. And there's just not a lot of representation at that top step level in the dugout.
Well, true. And I think Dusty Baker, you know, one of the lines that stuck with me in talking to him was people tend to hire their friends. You know, he kind of said it that way. And if that in power, if you're surrounded in this circle of people who reflect your values, look like you, reflect sort of the limited access to diversity in your private life, then it's very hard to sort of break that, you know, even with the best of intentions. You know, as Theo Epstein has sort of reflected on, it may not always be malicious, say, you know, you're like intending to keep other groups of people out. It may be just your favoritism towards people who are like you, the Ivy Leaguers or whatever it may be. So, you know, you have to look at that from power. And if you're not in a real true position of power to make these choices, and that the power structure actually embraces the experience, not just checking boxes, because, you know, I may check a box of diversity, but if you're not respecting what it means to actually live in that box, then you don't actually create the change that can make the sustainable types of change.
That's why the Tony La Russa hire to me is still so sour. I still have a really bad taste about it because of what we've known about that White Sox clubhouse and how Tim Anderson has been so open, not just in the way he carries himself on the field, but what he's doing off it and what is important to him and why it's important to him and what that's meant. And then out of nowhere, sort of deus ex machina, here comes Jerry Reinsdorf, my guy, here he is, and I'm bringing him here. And then the more we learn, the more we research, this is a guy with not only with a checkered racial history, but he stammers through a press conference giving his essential version of I can't be racist at all because here's all my black friends. And it left a really bad taste despite what he's trying to talk around. And this idea that he somehow has the privilege of deciding if a bat flip is sincere. And I don't know how it's going to work. I'm a lifelong White Sox fan who got really excited about this team that just feels incredibly conflicted and just the word I keep getting back to is sour and the distaste that I have about his hire. How do you feel about it and what it signifies?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I was actually there on SportsCenter when I saw that interview. I think it was Dan Le Batard where he was talking about Kaepernick. I didn't feel very good about it. And I actually went on air to respond to it. So somewhere in there's that response. And, you know, when you look at the Selig rule and what it was intending to do, there's two kind of lines of thought I think of. One is to get people in the room who weren't even accessed. And this sort of mythology, dispelling this mythology that, oh, creating diversity means you're taking less qualified people, right? There's that. And that's a very privileged perspective. And not seeing that my privilege is making me overlook these talented people that have been told that, oh, go to the minor leagues and pay your dues, and then as soon as you pay your dues, the rules change, and now we just have an apprenticeship, and we just handpick you. So that's the pathway of, say, a black manager or that experience. And through, you know, Kaepernick and sort of more awareness and reckoning George, you know, Floyd and Michael Brown and so on, policing, you know, we've seen what sports stances are going to be, these leagues. And when you think of the Selig rule in response to trying to create some diversity, the danger you have when you kind of don't take it seriously or you find loopholes and all these things is that there are candidates that are interviewing that are just box checking. You're just saying, okay, well, I interviewed Doug Glanville. Cool. Now I did my part on race. We're going to hire the guy we knew we were going to hire for the last 4 years. And I think in the White Sox, they had a history where there was regret about La Russa's firing back in the 80s. And yes, he's an incredible manager. He's had a great success with a lot of diverse players on his team. But the times changed so dramatically in the last 4 years that you have to see that he's, you know, been able to grow with that change. And I know he said things to indicate that, you know, he's tried to rethink it. I think, you know, he's going to get a shot, so he deserves a chance to sort of reflect that. But it will be very interesting to see with Tim Anderson, as you mentioned, very vocal and open players that are part of this diversity that are unapologetic about the fact that you have to challenge these issues, and some of which are reflected in some of the systemic issues that baseball faces every day.
I'm really looking forward to the programming that's on Marquee Sports Network tonight when it comes to Classes in Session and also the Cubs 360 special. When you have these kind of roundtable conversations with people who've been through similar situations growing up and they talk about it, a lot of people tend to ask, well, why are they doing this? You know, and I think I hate the fact that we still have to defend why we're doing this. But for those who might be listening, can you explain why these conversations do help, and they do matter, and they do help push us forward?
Well, Layla, I mean, you think of it, I see it in a positive light. For starters, you know, I'm honored to be in the professional sports world and playing baseball throughout my life, to now be in this position to commentate on, you know, to be a commentator on it. And the lessons of sport are understated. The whole stick to sports thing I reject, because sports actually give us a way in to look at the best of teamwork. It's a way in of seeing how people work together across historically divisive lines with different walks of life coming together for a championship, for a goal. That's a great lesson for the rest of our society. It's also a great lesson to see how sports are obsessed with equity and rules and fairness, you know, hence the scandals and the PEDs and the fight and the pushback to make it fair. When you're in an environment as a professional where you're constantly concerned about equity and equality, that's a great example for our country to follow. And so we want to use that opportunity to bring us together, because we do it often on the field. And why not use that example off the field? Now, my life, you know, if you care about these teams and the players that we root for and wear their jerseys and all these things who happen to be black, you realize that, you know, I hope by now you start to see that their life on the field does not match the life on off the field. My life between the white lines are very different outside the white lines. And yes, when you want to know why I went 0 for 12 in a week after the police pulled me over or whatever, maybe you want to understand that. And there's an opportunity to have a very fair discussion about that. So, you know, the head in the sand doesn't work, and it's certainly becoming more difficult to work with players who are openly now confronting what they've experienced all their lives, you know, as a person of color. So it's an opportunity, and I challenge sports to rise to the occasion and set the bar and reject this idea that sports cannot set a great example for the rest of society, because these athletes are in these environments learning every day how to work with different kinds of people. Why not set that tone for everyone else?
We're talking with Doug Glanville on the Bernstein and Rahimi Show on Sports Radio 670 The Score. A couple interesting things that I've been reading lately relative to what we're discussing right now. One is the fact that in sports, unlike in, say, elections, we all agree the results are real. That the one thing sports is doing, we don't have somebody lose a game and say, fake news, we actually won the game. And that it's giving us a common place where, at least in a sporting event, these football games over the weekend or basketball games, that we agree that the score is the score because we saw it happen in front of us, and saying that that's something from which we can build. The other thing I'm reading was across the board what you said before about diversity isn't something you do to say, okay, we did the diversity thing. When fundamentally, it's just good business. it's better for the health of your business, whether it's a sports team or whether it's a radio station, that whatever it may be, the reason for it isn't to comply. It's not to virtue signal. I hate that term, and anybody who uses it is likely an a-hole. But the idea of diversity is to make your business better. And once those lessons are actually learned, then I think people will better understand when it actually is healthier for the industry, healthier for business.
Yeah, well, that is, it's like walking in a room where you have different points of view to see things differently. And that is a valuable asset to any company. And I'll give you the economics. I use this all the time because, you know, Wells Fargo CEO had a comment about, unfortunately, there's not a lot of black talent for us to pull from. You know, that was sort of his comment. And it really offended me because I had been with Wells Fargo for eternity. But part of what you saw in that is this lack of awareness of the flip side of saying, diversity, if I go the other way and say, no, I don't, I'm just hiring, quote, on qualifications, you see the narrowness of that. And one example, they did a study, Citigroup did a study, and they counted $16 trillion of lost money to the economy due to racism and discrimination in banking over the last two decades, because there's actual damage. There's real damage. So you can measure it a lot of ways, but this idea that, okay, I checked the box, well, that's exactly what creates a problem, when you just see it as checking a box and getting people off your back. And so we do have a lot of work to shift that cultural sensibility towards realizing that it's the fact that we're overlooking and we're not looking, or we're intentionally looking in one direction for qualified, quote, qualified experienced candidates, when they're actually there, you just are, your own bias doesn't allow you to see it. And until you have people in the room that really can reflect all these vantage points, it's very hard to see past your own bias.
I know we joke about calling you the professor, also like Kyle Hendricks, and saying classes in session, but this is stuff that you teach as a professor. What are some lessons that we should take away or be mindful of today?
Well, to Dan's point about the scoreboard, I use an article about the scoreboard and sort of agreeing upon certain things that are universal in sports. And I think the takeaway I try to emphasize to my students is about the real power of sport, and that this is a great way to get into these issues, because it's very hard to get into them politically or through religion or directly through race or whatever. There's a lot of emotion there. But when you actually look at something where you see the fan bases of these teams and you say, wow, this is really a diverse swatch of our world, and we seem to agree that we love the Kansas City Chiefs or whatever it is, that's it seems small, but that is a very good way in. And because those players and those athletes and those sports have to find ways to work together, and they have to really focus on the goal. Torrey Hunter, who I interviewed for The Athletic at one point, said something along the lines of, you know, in sports, we have a goal. We have a common goal around our diversity to win. But he feels like in America, we don't quite have that goal. We haven't verbalized that this is an important way we need to move forward. It's too much about, oh, we have this pie of equality and you're taking a slice for me. But when you see power as something finite, yes, of course, you're going to run into these issues of thinking you're giving up something. But when you see it as infinite, which I'd argue it truly is, that you can create it, then you would understand that this actually makes us all stronger. And that is what I emphasize in the class. I always emphasize to the students that let's come at this through respect. Let's use sport as a way to discuss these issues. And let's have a plan forward. And so far, the students have embraced it.
There is a special Martin Luther King Jr. Day lineup on Marquee Sports Network tonight. Class is in session with Doug Glanville, starts at 7. Then it's The Life of Ernie Banks, More Than Mr. Cub, from 7:30 to 9. And then a Cubs 360 MLK Jr. Day special. But it all leads off with the show starring our guest, Doug Glanville. Doug, this is great. I wish we had a ton more time, because it's just endlessly fascinating. But thanks for taking the time to join us today.
All right, Dan, Layla, great to see you. Take care.
That is Doug Glanville.
Thanks, Doug.
The former Cub, and just a great guy. I do really suggest you take the time to read what he wrote at ESPN.com today about his relationship to baseball and what's important to him. And it was really some very special stuff. And he's a tremendous asset, and glad to have him. Next up, we'll talk a little bit of Bulls, because That was a hell of a road win yesterday, coming off of a terrible loss. And I know they beat an outmanned team, but Billy Donovan had some thoughts about what it means to learn how to win. And he's teaching his guys some lessons. So we'll talk some round ball next. And Bernstein Rahimi on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
It's Bernstein and Rahimi, middays on Chicago's Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Here's a slip cut to Wendell, left side marketing, stops, pops, and a three is good.
Here is Levine. Oh, what a three! Oh,
saucy.
Patrick Williams, one bounce. The rainbow three, good. Get out the umbrellas, Bill Whittington. It's raining trays.
They made him do something with it.
Oh, Kobe White.
That was deep from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Way downtown. You know the state well.
Oh, you know,
that geography.
I'm the governor, baby.
Kobe off the dribble. Top side three. Bam! Kobe White is putting on a show, folks, in Oklahoma City.
Looking for a little surge at the end of the half. Here it is.
Oh, give me that sauce.
Four threes. You were looking for it. Yep.
Heat check, baby.
A few minutes later.
Williams guarding Levine, who lost it.
Oh, man.
Dort with the takeaway.
Oh, my goodness. With 58 seconds to go, it'll be Thunderball. Bulls lead 118-113 on the Bulls' 21st turnover on the night.
Oh, foul. Wow. Kobe White.
Wow. Wow.
Pass in. Whoa. And is that a marketing foul?
Yes, it is. No need to panic.
Zach Levine for the lead and the win. Tip by Williams, no good. And off to overtime we go. Zach for the win. Left it short. And in overtime, the Thunder, after being down by 22 in the third, come all the way back to force OT and win it by a final of 127-125.
Bulls fans deserve better than this garbage.
And they got better. Yesterday, that was fun yesterday, and to see that response was pretty cool that they bounced back after that gut-wrenching and brutal a loss. I mean, that was like the Vinny Del Negro loss to the Sacramento Kings with Tyreek Evans, and they were up like 35 points in the third quarter or something and ended up losing that game, and Vinny's response was, it happens, and the point is, no, see, it doesn't, and that's why it's bad, is because that's not one of those things, you know, you get beat by a shot here or there, it happens. That wasn't the case, but that I was thinking about that when I was watching that all go down the other night, but they responded yesterday, and they won without Zach LaVine playing hero ball. Amazing, huh? They won without Kobe White having to score. Amazing, huh? It's like if you take care of the basketball and you move it around enough and you find some opportunities for guys. What did they hit? A total of 6 threes? That's all? And you get a road win?
Yeah, I got to go back and look at that. It wasn't. You're exactly right, though. The Bulls' backcourt was not. It was not balling out, so to speak. You know, and they still ended up making a game out of it against a depleted Mavericks team. And we talked about that, but still, you got to start somewhere. And yeah, they hit 7 threes in the game.
That's it. Yeah, hit 7 threes.
And Luka had a triple double, but it still didn't matter. They were able to sustain it.
He had the pass of the year so far as I'm concerned. The best pass I've seen in the NBA this year, where he goes behind the back with a dribble to himself and then gets Markkanen in the air and throws a behind-the-back pass for an open dunk, all in one amazing sequence. If you haven't seen it, just look up Doncic pass, and it should pop right up in your timeline. But I want to get to Billy Donovan, too, and what he's doing and how he's doing it to try to actually coach these Bulls. And he spent time at Saturday's practice talking about what it means to be ready to win and what it means to finish off a game like that and how he's trying to work on them psychologically to understand that.
There was a substance to those guys. You know, it was interesting, you know, just having Horford and Noah and like Brewer, just because those guys played in the NBA, Brewer was completely fearless and incredibly smart. Now, the one area for him, you know, as he came out of high school as a slasher and a driver, but he knew important points and times in games. And I've always said this about Noah and Horford. Like, if you threw the ball on the backboard with Noah and Horford, and they're in the lane by themselves with four of the guys around them, I'm putting my money on them. They're coming down with the rebound. Like, there's no doubt in my mind. Now, the one thing with Joe Kim that he had to learn, and I think Al helped him with this, and Joe was just all about competition, competing, 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 and a lot of times the attention to detail wasn't there. So when he first came to Florida, he didn't play all his freshman year, and a lot of it was because he didn't understand the importance of detail, and it took him some time to understand scouting reports, schemes. It can't be, I'm going to play harder than this guy. There's more to the game than that. And there's things that they had to learn. But now there was a substance to those guys competitively where, as you mentioned, there was a fearlessness. I'm not saying this about our group, but I've seen this. Sometimes people view competition as a threat, and other times people view competition as a challenge. And the one thing that competition does, it allows you to learn more about yourself and allows you to grow. Sometimes people look at competition as a threat, and they can get fearful and pull back and not want to throw themselves in the fray of it. Those three guys I just mentioned to you, they threw themselves in the fray of it. They took that on, and they were, like, incredibly competitive, and winning to them was the end-all, be-all. I do think the group here wants to win, but they're going to have to take another step and probably small incremental steps of finding out how important winning really is. Because I always say this in life, like I'd like to go to the moon. I really would. I have no interest in doing what it takes to become an astronaut. So, like, I want to win. Okay, great. Are you really willing to do what goes into winning? And what goes into this is, I think, what they're trying to learn right now. Now, as we go through that process, I have not seen anything from them that has given me the indication that they're not willing to put in the work. We've got to be really, to be honest with you, Joe, the concentration is a major problem. We have to be able to concentrate in the game. And I know things are happening quickly, and maybe guys, you don't want guys overthinking, but we don't concentrate. We have these spells for 3 and 4 or 5 minutes where we lose our concentration and focus, and we got to be able to do a better job of that.
Billy Donovan with good stuff answering Joe Colley's question as he was comparing his experience coaching the University of Florida and some of those guys, some of those future NBA players with what he's dealing with now. And it's fascinating to me because the way he coached after that loss was he showed them uninterrupted. He didn't splice together little bits and sequences and plays here and there. He said, watch the last 5 minutes. Watch us choke. And watch what you're doing. And that's the concentration he's talking about. That's kicking the ball around. That's dumb fouls. That's not knowing personnel. That's the wrong shot with the wrong amount of time left on the clock in the cycle of their offense. And they watched the whole thing in toto before they went out and beat the Mavericks and kept their concentration a little bit. And you talk about the difference, at least what I'm hearing, based on what I've been seeing over the weekend, what I'm hearing with the difference between competition as opportunity or competition as a threat, watch the Blackhawks defend. Watch the Blackhawks defend, and you will see professional athletes who appear threatened, just to my untrained eye. That's the difference I see. Like, it's a perfect description of the problems I see with Blackhawks defenders right now, of being fearful, of being a leaning back instead of forward, of reactive instead of active. And it's a big deal. So, and you say, oh, great. So you beat an outmanned Mavericks team, what, in middle of the day, whatever. It's a big deal to turn around that win, that loss into that win.
Yeah. To shorten slumps and to actually move past mistakes is the mark of good teams and good athletes. That's it. Everybody goes through that. It's just a matter of how you're going to rebound from that. Can't let one loss beat you twice. Something I've said too many times. Shout out to Jordan Malley, by the way, for that production value, which was just ridiculous. But, you know, I talked to Zach LaVine after games quite a bit last year, and you could tell that he had been bothered by the results of games that happened previously. But those streaks would turn into 2 and 3 losses and more. And now you're seeing this Bulls team rebound in a way that's really encouraging. I'm still, even though I worried about what happened in Oklahoma City, and the turnovers explained a lot of that, not to mention the failure of spacing on the final play, but also the fact that they hung with the Lakers so well. They hung with the Clippers so well. They come back and they let Luka Doncic get his yesterday, but then they walk away with the win. And you know, Dan, I just have a feeling with the NBA progressing like it is, we're going to be talking about this narrative of, well, this team had this many players out for a long time.
Yep.
Like, we're just going to have to accept that as part of the NBA season because they're asking us to and their players to. And we saw more games get postponed yesterday. But when it comes to how the Bulls are improving and the steps that they're taking, they're significant. We would be focusing on what happened on Friday a lot more if they didn't go into Dallas, face a Western Conference team, one of the best players in the league, and with Porzingis, by the way. And they were able to work. And we haven't even talked about the fact that Larry Markkanen has improved.
Well, I was just going to bring him up because that's who he's talking to. That's what I hear. That if you had to imagine one Chicago Bull hearing this about how they view competition each night or each trip down the floor, that's the guy. And I don't think his conditioning has quite caught up because he was out for a while. He's still not physically strong enough. But I do see him in attack mode. I do see him, at, whether or not it's in his heart, whether or not he's doing it grudgingly or not. I don't know that he's just a natural sort of rip your throat out kind of competitor. But fake it and as long as you can. And if that's what it takes, if it takes him telling himself, "I'm a competitor, I'm going to go out and get it." If that's the professional headspace in which he needs to exist, that I liked it. I like seeing it. And then the other open jumpers are going to come. But so much of that comes off attacking. I loved when he rebounds his own miss and is then in a position to put it in. I love that. I love the fact that he doesn't give up on stuff like that and the opportunities that he creates by following his own shot. Even if it's not going to go in, seeing how it's going to come off and getting either slapping it back or grabbing it himself. I hear a lot of that directed at him. And They're learning. And look, Eversley and Karnišovas have to see all this. They got to watch it. They need a much larger sample. But to see the formula that they used to win that game is certainly interesting because it may tell you about the potential future of Zach LaVine.
It's also adjusting. You're seeing adjustments being made. They're not going to go whole drop defense if it's not working. Bring back the zone a little bit. Mix up your coverages. If your backcourt isn't scoring at will, figure out how to make it work. Bench had 61 yesterday. 61. You know how many the Mavericks bench had? 22.
Larry
Markkanen gets the double-double. That's not. I don't think that works. But you know what I'm trying to say. Like, this is all working together in a way where somebody else is going to step up, and you're seeing that start to take place. And I like Garrett Temple, man.
Yeah, he's an old vet. That's an old crusty vet that knows what he's doing. And it did see, I was noticing schematically, at least early, they were showing us kind of a new look at the top of their offense using a staggered double screen instead of a single ball screen that could then be adjusted to. It's an interesting wrinkle. And usually, it's weird, because usually the staggered double is an off ball. It's a weak side set. It gets back to old school NBA. They call it floppy action. You used to see it with Rip Hamilton when you had your ball handler and your two guard would run around a series of screens. You set one over here and a stagger over here. It's old classic NBA. But to use it for the ball handler is a little bit of a different twist. And they had some actions off it. They made it harder to switch. Because if you know that second screen is coming, by the time you've switched the first one, now you've got to make another decision where you may have that height mismatch that is advantageous to you. So it's some of the intricacies of what Donovan's doing I find really cool. And it tells me that there are some brighter minds actually watching these games instead of talking about heart and spirit and soul. And we get to talk some silliness next because the Midday Midway is coming up. You know what I have? I have cocaine hippos.
What?
And members of cocaine hippos. Nope. They're a problem. They have to be dealt with. We've got an issue with cocaine hippos.
Heck yes.
Mm-hmm.
Not only can you not figure out time in this era of 2020, 2021, neither can the Earth. The Earth is messing with us.
Oh, no. Lovely. Yep. That's all coming your way next. We'll get into it on the Midday Midway. Bernstein and Rahimi on the Score.
We've had some boots to asses, and we'll continue to have that.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
the first half or the second half. You know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel
the Midday Midway with Bernstein and Rahimi. Middays 9 a.m. to noon on The Score.
It's been a busy non-Bears Monday, and we'll have non-Bears Mondays for a while now. But we did talk football, having seen so much of it over the weekend. Maybe not as exciting as the previous weekend. I think, Layla, you're right in that regard. But we talked about the jealous energy with some of these connections. We see the Bears play, the Javon Wims drop play that gets run successfully by the Chiefs with Jameis Winston. We see that fourth and one play that Andy Reid runs is a sprint action similar to something that the Bears do, and there they are, out of the shotgun, making it work because, you know, they're better at it. And then we looked at NFL dysfunction also connected to the Bears. All of the problems with the Eagles and apparent insurrection there. I shouldn't use that word. Insubordination is a better word. With the Carson Wentz deciding to just not run plays that were sent in. And then the Texans and the insanity that's happening there. The great story that Jenny Vrentis wrote the cover story for SI over the weekend. And the Jack Easterby problem and the Deshaun Watson availability. My conclusion, I think you're right that he will be elsewhere, but there's no way he's going to be dumb enough to approve any deal to the Bears. And then Doug Glanville was his always intelligent, entertaining, and professorial self. We also praise the Bulls for pulling themselves out of a self-induced tailspin.
Why you got to kill my vibe? Why you got to ruin my dreams of Deshaun Watson coming here?
Because he's not coming here.
All right.
Why
fine.
Would he? He's not dumb. He knows what he's doing. He's got control of. All right. So why is am I having a complete inability to understand time?
Well, scientists have your back on this, and you're right. I'm being dramatic and ridiculous about Deshaun, but I don't care. Scientists say the Earth is spinning faster than it has in decades. Spinning faster, which theoretically means less time to work with.
Well,
as noted
faster?
On Live Science. Yeah, so this is a story noted on Live Science. The Earth's fastest 28 days on record since 1960 all occurred in 2020, with Earth completing its revolutions around its axis milliseconds quicker than average. Milliseconds. But they add up, don't they? Usually the Earth is an excellent timekeeper. With respect to the sun, it rotates once every 86,400 seconds, which equals 24 hours. That is called a solar day, but it's not perfect because none of us are. And so it can vary by milliseconds. And for whatever reason this year, the Earth has had enough of 2020 and it decided to speed up a little bit.
Why? Does it often speed up and slow down? Or is this a trend that it could spin so fast we all fly off?
I think because of gravity and physics and such, we wouldn't probably fly off. Like, other things would have to happen. Like, the sun, you know, the planets all aligned and nothing really happened there either, if you'll recall. But
yes,
this is the fastest that it has spun in decades. Apparently, 1960 also had this situation occur. So, I found that kind of interesting. The Earth's rotation can change slightly because of the movement of its core and also surprisingly because of weather and ocean patterns. Because, you know, water makes stuff move around. Changes
sure.
So in the atmosphere.
As the polar ice caps melt and there's more water, you can have more tidal effect.
Perhaps. It says changes in the atmosphere, specifically atmospheric pressure around the world and the motions of the winds that may be related to such climate signals as El Nino, a.k.a. the Nino, are strong enough that their effect is observed in the Earth's rotation signal. That was by the way, that's like one of the cool things about moving to Chicago that happens is everybody refers to El Nino as the Chris Farley, the Nino. like where I came from, it was just a weather pattern. Not here. No, it's Saturday Night Live sketch.
Pablo Escobar's hippos are taking over the marshlands of Colombia. And they may need to face the same fate as their late owner before they become impossible to control, so warn scientists. These so-called cocaine hippos were illegally imported to the country by the notorious drug lord, who was shot dead by authorities in 1993. This is according to the Telegraph. The rapidly breeding beasts have grown to become the largest invasive species on the planet and could reach dangerous numbers in the next two decades. Nobody likes the idea of shooting a hippo, but we have to accept that no other strategy is going to work, said ecologist Natalie Castelblanco Martinez. When Escobar was killed, authorities took control of his 7,000-acre estate, including a personal zoo. While most of the animals found homes at zoos elsewhere, four of the hippos escaped. With no real predators, they are anywhere between 80 and 100 descendants of his former pets, terrorizing the country's lakes and rivers. Scientists have projected the hippo population could surge to 1,500 by 2024. Their excretions are toxic, potentially sickening other species and even humans. And a government environmentalist said they're racing to castrate them before they take over. That's a job. Go get them, Steve. Okay. You have the shears? Yep. All right. If you got like a little pith helmet on, he's like,
well,
let me get the first one. And the hippo's like, yeah, what are those shears for? Could you just give me a sec? Yeah, no. They fear that there's no option now other than to slaughter them. They say relocation might have been possible 30 years ago when there were only four hippos. They said castration could have been effective if officials had provided sufficient resources for the program early on, but a cull is now the only option. And these are, they are deadly, nasty, angry animals. They are not cute and cuddly by any stretch. There's video of them swimming fast enough to keep up with speedboats. And there was the story that we did a couple of weeks ago about the guy who had his pet hippo, who he said loved him like a son until it dragged him through the water and ate him. So that's just don't mess around with these things. As long as they're contained in Colombia, I'll be happy enough. But who's signing up for that job? It's like, hey, there's an environmental job for you. What is it? Oh, you got to go castrate a bull hippo.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, no thanks.
Doesn't there have to be some sort of like alligator Bob or something, like that dude who caught the alligator in Humboldt Park for this situation? Like, you just fly in the expert and he has the tools.
That was
to make
alligator Frank. Yeah, alligator Bob didn't know what he was doing. He was just sort of floating around until they called alligator Frank, who was an actual gator wrangler. And then Frank Robb, I want to say his name was, and he came in from Florida, did the job. Yeah, but if you're talking already 100 that they think may breed quickly enough to be 1,500 in 3 years. No, that's like helicopters and M60s. That's not a guy in a canoe, because you don't mess with these things.
No, there's probably a lot of tranquilizer that goes into all of that and the efforts therein, like a lot of tranquilizer. But you
for
know,
the
you
castration
describe
part?
The hippos.
Yeah, I would hope.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but you describe these hippos as angry and terrorizing, but they're probably hungry hippos too.
Stop
just
it.
Saying.
Meanwhile, I always tell this story with the kids. When the kids were very little, we would play Hungry Hippos. And there was a spot on the floor in the basement that wasn't quite level. So depending if you sat in the proper spot, you could always win Hungry Hippos. Because they all gently rolled to you, not drastically, but just enough that you could reasonably win every game. And I would tell the kid, I'm just better at it than you are, apparently. Look, let's turn the game. I won't use the yellow one now. I'll use the red one, and I'll still beat you. So eventually they figured it out, because I think my daughter said, I want to sit over there, and you sit over here. I'm like, are you sure? And they figured it out. But that was...
Mean.
No, you got to do that. Trust me. Anybody who had... And thankfully, my kids now, they're old enough to know to stay away from me and not want to spend time with me as much. But you do anything to entertain yourself when you have children of a certain age who, when it's your primary job in life, is to... Where every 5 minutes feels like an hour and a half. And there's only so many times you can play Tea Party or play Kitchen or play or read the same book or listen to the Wiggles. And once you get out of that part of your life, you feel like you've been released from the gulag. it's true, and everybody's nodding along. He's right, you know. Hub Arkish is going to talk some football with us next. Keep it here. You have the score.
T
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.